Hello and welcome to my Yellow Bench. I'm Liv Cropper, I'm a transformational leadership coach, and this is Rooted, the human side of sustainability leadership. In every episode of Rooted, I talk with a sustainability leader about their roots in this work, the impact they're most proud of, how they've kept grounded along the way, and the seeds of wisdom they can share with us. In every conversation, we'll talk about how it really feels to do this work. So, if you're ready for today's episode, please take a seat. In today's episode of Rooted, I am thrilled to welcome an absolute queen of sustainable investing. She's got close to 20 years in the business, having led responsible investing at Scottish Widows with around £200 billion of assets under management at her time there, and is now global head of sustainable investment at IFM Investors with a massive £115 billion of assets under management there. She shares her expertise, her time, and her energy very generously. She is a visiting lecturer at Cambridge University. She's a board member for UKCIF, which is the UK Sustainable Investment and Finance Association. And beyond that, she's shared her expertise and time with countless other panels, advisory roles, and public speaking opportunities. So I want to say welcome to Rooted, Maria Nazarova-Doyle.
Thank you so much, Liv. Thank you for having me. It's a great privilege to be selected.
It's really lovely to have you. And I hope you'll enjoy the experience. Now, remember, on Rooted, we're going right beneath the surface to really explore how it really feels to do this work. So I will be probing you a lot through the interview, but I hope you'll enjoy it too. And it'll be great to really hear about all of the experiences that you've had through your career. So I'm really looking forward to it as well.
Excellent. I'm ready.
Yeah, let's start. So I'm really interested in this one. Maria, where did your roots in this work begin? Because I know you've been in the business for a long time and you then moved into the sustainable, responsible investing side of it through your time in the business. What drove that move and what drove that kind of drive into sustainability and responsible investing?
Yeah, so sustainable investing is a kind of field that people tend to either come through the sustainable part of it or the investing part of it. And for me, that was the investment route. I've started my career in private equity. It was really exciting. I found the world of finance really challenging, you know, intellectually stimulating, but it just felt like something was missing at the time for me. And I was looking for something bigger, maybe as a young graduate, you know, you're sort of looking for something that's probably more impactful, you know, yeah. where you feel like you're really doing something good with your skills. And that was a point at which I thought I would take some time out, I'll take a master's degree, and I'll have a think what kind of career I actually want after that. And that's how I found pensions. And I kind of want to say I never looked back, you know, because I still feel like I'm a pensions professional, even though I'm a sustainability professional.
Yeah.
For me, it was the area where people actually needed a lot of help. So people needed help, particularly for defined contribution pensions, in your way, it's all about what you invest in, you know, and how well it does. And that's all you get to retire on. So from investment consulting point of view, there was a very rewarding type of job. You know, most people don't even know they're in a pension scheme or, you know, how it works. And then they're toiling away trying to make sure they have money to retire on. So I found that just a fantastic calling, I guess, in a sense. And I did a lot of investment consulting for pension funds. But when you do that, given the extremely long investment horizons that pension funds have, you know, 20, 30, 40 years and plus, it is kind of impossible to give advice on investment strategy without considering long-term risks and long-term opportunities.
Yeah.
So pretty early kind of in my consultant career, I started thinking about it, looking for ways to bring that into sort of more traditional, you know, number crunching investment consulting modeling. And I think a catalyst was the work by DWP, a few years ago when they decided to make all pension funds have an ESG policy, and that just opened a huge door to actually having those conversations with trustees, you know, to be able to bring those issues formally to the table. And, you know, I guess we can say that the UK pensions industry has never looked back. Now sustainability is firmly integrated into how our pension assets are managed all across the UK. So for me, that was the time where I could formally start doing more and more on this, which was super exciting. And I guess it's a bit like Hotel California, you can check out, you know, but basically once you start doing sustainability, you can't really leave because it's such an exciting and rewarding field. It's very fast moving, so it's always again kind of stimulating and interesting, but at the same time, it never feels like a job because you feel like you're doing something good, you know, your work really matters, there's a real impact in the world. So that's the kind of job where you'll work 24/7 and don't really feel like you're working, you know. So I guess I just got really, really passionate about that and never looked back. And this is how I've ended up at Scottish Widows, where the job was, I guess, quite specifically, I guess, on the cusp sort of between sustainability and investment, or maybe you could say that it had both, you know. So I was looking after the pension investment proposition, which means like deciding how all of this is invested. And at the same time, I was tasked with setting up the responsible investment stewardship team, which obviously then is an integral part of how pensions are invested. So that was a really exciting time. We operated as a bit of a startup within a very large organization with lots of resources, which was kind of best of both worlds, I guess.
Yeah.
So to have an opportunity to set up something so new and so impactful for an organization with £200 billion of assets and 200 years of history was kind of once in a lifetime experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And now I've come all the way back to private markets. You know, if you remember starting private equity, now I'm back in private markets, but in a purpose-driven organization, which takes the sustainability integration very seriously, you know, the stewardship very seriously, really looks at systemic issues. Because ultimately, we can only be as successful with our investments as the economy and the environment and all the systems around us, you know, because we invest for very long term in private markets. A lot of it is an infrastructure, which again gives you an interesting challenge, you know. So when we talk about transition, energy transition, you know, net zero transition, this is exactly what needs to be transitioned. It's the infrastructure that we'll rely on. So in terms of job satisfaction, I guess it's through the roof because we're actually moving this infrastructure forward, you know, to low carbon options. It's helping with, you know, social license to operate, you know, with all the work with communities and workers, just creating stronger kind of social systems. And it's still pensions for me. It's owned by pension funds. So Australian and Nest in the UK is one of our newest additions to the owner group. And there's just something about pensions, right? Because of how long-term they are, I think there's always that link to sustainability. And then if you overlay private markets on it, it just becomes a place where, I guess, magic happens, if I can say that, because you have long-term capital coming from pension funds invested in private markets for long-term into long-term strategy in a sustainable way, right? It's just, I guess, the dream job.
And I love how passionate you are about the way that all of these sort of things that have driven you through your life, this drive to do good, this drive for an exciting and challenging and mentally stimulating work, have all kind of combined together by the sounds of it in where you are now. So that just sounds like a fascinating story to tell in terms of what's got you to where you are today, really. Do you feel like that kind of drive to do good in the world and make an impact, has that always been there?
I think so. I'm trying to go back, you know, in time when I was back at school and things I'm teaching my daughter now. I think particularly what strikes me is the kind of the advocacy part of my character, you know. So I've never been shy to advocate for myself or for my classmates, you know, for my friends, you know, it's trying to organize people to, you know, demand better conditions, better, you know, kind of better study materials, you know, all of this. So I guess I was just always trying to, I'm quite an outgoing personality, and I was using that to then help others who maybe were a bit less outgoing, you know. Yes. So I'm trying to say, well, how can we actually improve the situation we're in? So sustainability in terms of, I guess, climate and nature came to the forefront of my thinking, again, when I was a kid, and through Jacques-Yves Cousteau, you know, and the programs that he was making for the underwater world. I mean, it was just something so just outworldly and incredible and unusual. And that, you know, brought the whole world into my, you know, small telly screen in a small town. And it just opened up, I guess, my eyes in terms of how big the world is, how precious it is, you know, how precious nature is. And that was always sort of a part of my drive.
So that's great. And I love hearing about how you take on that advocate role within your classmates and how over the time, you know, that's grown and grown.
Policy advocacy, you know, and kind of cross-country collaborations, you know, it's amazing when I kind of look back and trace it back. It's actually, yeah, it's I never would have thought this would be the case.
You've always been doing this. So when you look at the work that you've done, perhaps over your career, you're only sort of partway through what is obviously, you know, a very impactful career. But as you look as to what you've done to date, what branch of the journey that you've been on so far would you say you've been able to make the biggest impact? What are you most proud of?
It's such a difficult question in a way, because if I think about different projects and things that I've done, you know, there's been so many that's been very challenging, but then also rewarding. And, you know, they were really interesting to be part of. And I feel like a sense of achievement. But actually, if I take a step back, I think I'm probably really most proud of the teams that I've assembled. And none of it would have been possible without the teams around me. And I just love doing it. It's one of the things I really, really enjoy is assembling a strong, empowered, you know, diverse team, because sustainability is a tricky subject. You really need to have different perspectives. You know, you really need to have people who are self-starting, you know, who are passionate about it, you know, who are ready to face longer term, but also shorter term challenges. You know, it's all not all about long term and what happens in 20 or 30 years. You know, there are issues we need to deal with right now, you know, and then it gets like the multiplier effect. You know, there's only so much I can do by myself, and I can do so much more if I have the right team around me. And it's also more fun, obviously, to work in a great team. So maybe there's like a bit of a selfish part of it as well. I just like to have a nice team, you know.
Yes. And so how do you do that then? So you've obviously got some things that you're looking for, but how do you find these great people, or how do you select them?
I try to find a combination of technical ability and then that sort of diverse way of thinking and diverse backgrounds. I want people to come from different fields, you know, in one team. So I don't want to have, like, in consultant, I don't want all consultants, you know, in sort of investment, I don't want all investment people. Like, I really like what people bring when they kind of come across from a different field with a different background, and that mix then of backgrounds and perspectives and sort of track record makes teams much, much stronger. I can feel it just in myself, you know, by being an asset manager, an asset owner, an investment consultant. I have so many hats that I can kind of put on and take off, you know, and then makes me think differently about issues. So multiply that by a team, you know, that comes from different perspectives, and they can have discussions, you know, about ways forward for difficult situations, you know, unsolvable kind of wicked problems. That's the only way really to tackle that. So yeah, so it's a combination of the difference of technical skills, because, you know, you need somebody who knows a lot about social factors and somebody who knows a lot about nature or, you know, climate and that kind of thing, right? So the technical skills are really important. But it's, I guess, maybe probably we can call them softer skills and the backgrounds, you know, that are very important too. And kind of, I want to have gender mix, I want to have nationalities mix, you know, so it's everybody brings different perspectives. And if you think about kind of West and East, you know, there's different ways of looking out for risks and, you know, the world, right? So it just makes it so much more effective as a team. The downside, I guess, in a way, is that it could be very uncomfortable, you know, so it's much more comfortable to have a team where everybody agrees with everything. Everybody comes from sort of the same background, the same kind of schooled approach, you know, of doing things. And then it's much more pleasant to work like that, right? When everybody's the same, thinks alike. So in a team, like the teams that I build, It's not very comfortable. I'm sure they're listening now. But yeah, it's not easy. So it's pretty much the same for all my kind of teams and my current team. You know, it's not easy, but it's the best way of doing it. And I have taught myself to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I think that's a really important thing to do if you want to get more out of the team, you know. And I want to be uncomfortable, you know, because they're fighting back on the decisions that I'm making. You know, I want to be uncomfortable because sometimes they know more than I do. You know, I want that kind of sense of kind of being a bit, oh, I'm not sure I'm like always the smartest in the room. I'm not sure I always get to call the shots, you know, but actually that makes it so much better because essentially as a team, we don't have any blind spots because everything is covered. You know, it's like it's a 360 vision basically.
And how do you help as a leader? How do you help your team, you know, come into your team and be a part of that discomfort? How do you kind of work with that and help people acclimatize to it?
I try to spend time with my team. So either one-to-one and then kind of try to get to know them and connect with them. It works differently, you know, for different people. Again, like some people really like to connect on a personal level, so maybe don't like to do that. Some people like to connect with you on sort of on the work kind of level, right? And then those are the people I work with together on projects, you know. So, but it's the one-to-one, but also it's the time with the team. I think it's so important to spend time as a team, to work on things as a team, but also to spend social time outside of work, time face-to-face. You know, I'm sure we'll touch upon difficult times and in the past, and, you know, COVID pandemic was a very difficult time. In terms of that human connection, you know, and how to have that when you actually don't see each other at all, and, you know, can't go for a coffee and can't do like a volunteering team fundraising or something like that, right? So I think it's that one-to-one time and time as a team and trying to create an environment that is not just work focused, but is outside of work focused as well.
Yeah, lovely. Well, maybe as you've started to touch on those tougher times, maybe we'll segue into that, shall we, and talk about that a bit more. I guess this work is, it can feel like a roller coaster at times, can't it? And, you know, there are great times and then there are more difficult seasons, both in terms of the wider political context or whether it's just, you know, yourself personally or the organization or the team or whatever goes through a tough time. So what has been difficult? What has felt more challenging for you as you look back?
I think since I've mentioned COVID pandemic, I probably should talk a little bit about that. I mean, it was an extremely difficult time for all of us, just getting through the day with the news that we were getting all the time. I mean, sometimes I forget, you know. I think it's like a trauma.
We do, don't we?
It's a trauma that the brain is trying to help us deal with by just hiding it somewhere
blocking
in some storage
out.
Box. Yes, it's exactly. I feel that that's what's happening. And then sometimes I'm reminded about it, or I even actually actively try to force myself to remember and compare and, you know, feel grateful for what we have now versus, you know, what we had to deal with then. And it was a really scary time. And like on the personal level, I think what helped me through that was work, was the fact that I just threw myself into work.
Yeah.
I had something important to do. I just joined Scottish Widows at the time and I was building my team all online, you know, so I was hiring online. We're, you know, creating that team kind of spirit all online, which, you know, was a tough thing to do. But at the same time, we all had this fantastic opportunity, you know, to integrate sustainability into this massive investment book, you know, so we all felt hugely passionate about that and, you know, encouraged by that. And I think looking back, all of us just worked crazy hours. I remember going to like the board and and they were going, surely you didn't spend enough time considering this. Maybe you need more time. And I'm like, no, because we were working like 15-hour days. You know, like we're putting double shifts, to be able to put a proposal in place, you know. So we were doing so much research and analysis and work because there was nothing else. You know, there was no social life. There was nothing else. So actually part of the success of the team, I would definitely attribute to the fact that that was the only thing we were doing, you know, and we just threw ourselves into it, which then inevitably, obviously, took its toll, you know, on relationships and health and mental health, I suppose, you know. So there's always that kind of flip side to the coin, right? But at the same time, I think that work is what got us through it. It was something that definitely got me through it, you know. So I kept my sanity throughout because I was just focused on a very specific thing, you know, like our divestment program, our new fund creation program, you know, so the kind of sustainability focused new mandates, you know. It just felt like while the world is just going who knows where, right, is basically crumbling in front of us, we're actually doing something to help in a different way, but to help in a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. And when I think about my own experience and the people that I know and knew through that period of time, actually, what you're saying really resonates, because for you, you kind of got through it by having a really strong purpose and a strong thing to do. Obviously, there was others that went through that time with, you know, an urgent purpose. You know, I'm thinking of people, kind of the key worker people on the front line of the response. And I think for them, obviously, it really took its toll in quite a significant way. And I compare that to my own experience, where the work that I was doing at the time, it was all important in the perspective of the environment, and it was all environmental initiatives. But every single thing that I happened to be doing at that time involved people being in offices. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they weren't there anymore and they were all at home. And everything I was working on just fell away. And it was like, oh God. And I had no purpose for that period of time. And it took a while to kind of build it back up. Okay, what does this look like? What do we need to do in this changing world? But I really struggled with that time of, I just was like, what do I do? Everything stopped. All my projects have been stopped. So yeah.
How did you deal with that, Liv? Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to ask questions.
No, we can go back and no, it's fine. I mean, actually, you know, for me, how I took some time out, and I kind of said to my boss at the time, and she was fantastic. I said, look, I just need a bit of time to kind of hunker down and be with my kids and give myself the purpose through them in terms of what they needed from me as their mother. So I just really focused in on that. And that then brought me through it. And, you know, then I kind of was able to get back into the projects and start building up the portfolio of work again in that new world. But yeah, I think having a purpose and having that sort of strong sense, although, as you say, it drove you into some very long hours, I think it also got a lot of people through those tough times. How did you come out of it? I mean, did you sort of come out and we're all still doing 15-hour days and having no lives, or how did the transition back out of it work?
I'm a little healthier now in my work habits. I can't say I don't work long hours just because I work for an Australian headquartered company, you know, so with a big office in the US as well. So it just sort of still ends up being, you know, kind of out of hours calls and all that. But I'm probably better at balancing it and like forcing myself to take breaks and just being less silly about it, you know. So there was a catalyst to it, is that when I was at Scottish Widows, and it was kind of towards the end of tenure with Scottish Widows, which is like nearly 4 years I was there, there was a leadership sort of resilience program that I was nominated for. And part of that was a physical assessment. And I had to wear monitors all over my body basically for 3 days nonstop. And it was measuring like levels of stress and heart rate and sleep and, you know, all of this. And then you send them away and then they give you a report. And essentially my report was what made me realize I probably need to take a lunch break, you know, because you could see like the level of stress. So I'm sleeping, I'm fine. And I wake up and you could see the time I start work and it just goes straight into the red and it just stays in red all the time, pretty much until I, you know, finish my long day and went to sleep. It was really bad. The advice that came with that was that, yeah, I was just not that far away from burnout, which I guess was a very lucky timing to catch that, you know, and to give me that sort of wake up call in terms of my working patterns. So
amazing that you had that opportunity to find that out before it
actually hit, which would have been much harder to deal with, you know. So,
yes.
So at that time, I was already doing yoga. I mean, I've been doing yoga for a long time, over 20 years. But that's when I thought, okay, I really need to make it a daily routine. I need to make sure I start my day with yoga in the morning, no matter what. And then I need to try and, you know, either force myself outside or take a lunch break or, you know, just make sure there's a variety to my day, you know, and it's kind of a healthy type of variety. And that really helped. And it really helped a lot. And I talked to my husband about it, to, you know, some of my colleagues and friends, and said, you need to keep me honest on this, you know, because it's easy to just slide into the existing pattern. So they helped as well. And I think that's probably why I actually still can do quite a lot of work without burning out. And I've avoided that. And I know quite a few people who weren't so lucky. And it's a really tough place to be and a really hard work to get back out. So I'm just extremely grateful to have had that opportunity to find out that I was very close.
That's so interesting. And as you say, it's a bit of a myth almost that burnout is sort of simply, if you like, caused by overwork. Because you can actually work quite a lot and be fine, but it's having those practices and those moments of pause and rest and the mindset that you approach it with, you know, so it's a bit simplistic, isn't it? Just to say, oh, long hours equals burnout. It's not as simple as that. Do you still keep up with those practices now, or does it ebb and flow?
I mean, it depends, right? I mean, last week I went to New York and I took my yoga mat with me. And I did yoga once, you know, so I really tried, but it was a really, really busy week. And it was really important to sort of maximize the opportunity of being there, you know, so I can't say I'm passing with flying colors, but I'm still kind of very determined. And, you know, I feel bad and guilty when I don't do it. So I guess that means my habit has changed, you know, so it's really helping me now. And I've cut out caffeine as well, because that can add to your levels of stress, you know. So a few years ago, and I only now use caffeine tactically when I go to Australia, and it's exactly the other side, you know, of the clock, and I do need a little bit of coffee or a little bit of tea, and it works a treat, because I'm not used to it anymore at all, you know. So
yes.
And I think sustainability professionals are probably more prone to burnout, because not just because of the hours, but they do volunteer. They tend to volunteer a lot, yes, you know, for yes, longer hours, because we're so passionate about what we do. So we take it very close to heart, right? So again, that creates stress, that creates kind of anxiety, that creates, you know, like, you're just very close to the work you're doing. You can't really distance yourself from it. And that, I think, mentally sort of adds to the load, you know, that then could create burnout, because you're emotionally so invested. You're kind of thinking about it all the time. You're feeling all of it. You know, it's not just a job. It's something that's very, very important to us. So unfortunately, sustainability professionals are probably people who are doing some very hard work, but also some of the most prone to burnout.
Yeah. What you've just said is kind of exactly what I feel like I'm banging on about all the time, actually. But I think it's, you know, you started by talking at the beginning of this conversation about your values, if you like, you know, that kind of drive to do good in the world, and that drive to do work that's exciting and challenging and intellectually stimulating. And a lot of people in sustainability, I think, are driven by similar kinds of values or beliefs around that. And I think that's where it can become a bit tricky and a bit dangerous, if I might say, because you're never done. You're never done with the impact. You're never done with, you know, I could be delivering a bigger impact. I could be doing more good in the world. So yeah, I think it's amazing that you had that wake up call, I suppose, really.
I just see it as a very lucky, because I just know that I wouldn't have made those interventions. Kind of, I wouldn't have volunteered for them just all of a sudden, you know. So that was very, very helpful.
So that's a bit of a vote for those executive screening type programs, isn't it? We need them. We need them. Let's move into, I guess, bearing in mind everything we've spoken about, really, what advice would you give to other sustainability leaders? What seeds of wisdom would you plant for others?
I think we can bank the bit about look after yourself, right? We talked about that.
Yes, that's a big one.
That is definitely a big one, because we need you all with your full potential, you know, on top form, right? So that's very, very important. But the other thing I've been thinking about lately in particular, I guess, is which facing all these geopolitical headwinds, you know, so it's just very interest in, let's say, political environment in different countries and the rise of populism and, you know, further stratification of society and all of these kind of scary things that are happening, is that, like, it's important to keep some optimism throughout, important to focus on, I guess, the longer term, you know, so how do we chart the path to the future that we know is right, you know, it's a cleaner, greener, more inclusive, you know, more sustainable society and economy and the world around us. So, like, I don't feel like there's an alternative. The alternatives are all short term, right? A long term, this is the only alternative. And I think it's just trying to keep some optimism, some positivity, maybe finding support and others who are working in this field, you know, not kind of give in to panic and anxiety and, you know, depression, which sometimes feels like it's just a short step away, you know, but myself and the team will have matching t-shirts saying keep calm and invest sustainably. And that's a bit of a motto for the team, you know. Yeah. we're trying to remind ourselves, you know, to just, this is the right thing, you know, just keep calm. Yes. don't panic, don't get swayed by the short-term kind of 24-hour news cycle, you know, just keep doing what you think is right and what you know will prevail, because there's no other alternative. It's that long-term sustainability of the planet and the economy that's going to make us all successful.
Just a bit of a reflection as you're talking is, as I talk to lots of different sustainability leaders, I find that there's a fairly decently sized cohort of people who've been around just probably long enough to know that this stuff comes in cycles. And, you know, they've seen it get really, you know, excited. It's the big new thing. And then they've seen it kind of pull back and it's a bit less important or a bit less high on the radar. And then there's another big moment. And so I think when you've gone through a few of those cycles, it seems like you can get a bit of perspective. And the perspective that you've just given there is, it's an imperative. It has to be done. This is a long-term problem. There's no getting away from it. It's just sometimes we talk about it more and less, and sometimes the excitement levels change. But I think what I do talk a lot also to newer sustainability professionals, and I think right now it does feel really tough. It, you know, and I think for them it feels like, oh God, well, you know, have I chosen the right career? I've heard that a few times. Have I gone down at the wrong path? Is this going to be a mistake for me personally to have kind of put all my eggs in this basket? But you're saying you have to just keep that long-term perspective.
Oh, absolutely. And I also think that we need sustainability everywhere. So even if maybe for the time being or for however many years ahead, maybe we are at the kind of bottom of the cycle and we don't need so many people in sustainability, the skills and the knowledge could be transferred and should be really transferred everywhere, because we don't want just sustainability teams doing sustainability. We want all of the teams doing sustainability. We want marketing, we want comms, we want compliance, you know, yes. We want manufacturing, engineering, and, you know, so we want sustainability to be integrated everywhere. So actually people with those skill sets, I don't think that, you know, it's, I mean, I don't want to invalidate their fears, but it just, to me, it doesn't feel like a valid fear to say I chose the wrong career, that particular bit, because those skills are applicable everywhere and they need to be brought in everywhere. You know, as businesses are grappling, you know, with like rising costs of energy or, you know, some supply chain disruptions, all of it, building in sustainability principles into any type of business operation is crucial for long-term success. And we're already seeing lots of companies doing it very successfully, and some are sort of starting to. So I feel like sustainability skills and knowledge could be used in so many different ways. You don't need to just be in a sustainability team. You know, it could be any other team and use that to the advantage of that whole team.
Very wise words. Yeah, I think. And keeping that energy and that positive mindset, really important. You were going to say something else.
Yeah. So it's like bit different. So this more on the kind of technical skill side, I guess. So thinking about sustainability leaders, right? And sustainability leaders, again, same as we were talking about sustainable investment, there's sustainable part and then there's investment part. There's also two parts to sustainability leader. There's the sustainability part, which is like the technical core skills, and the leader part, and which is the leadership softer skills, you know?
Yeah.
And I would encourage those who aspire to be sustainability leaders to really try and give some time to the leadership part. I think it goes without saying that, you know, everybody's going to focus on the technical skills, and it's really important to have the right technical skills and really understand the subject matter. But at a certain point in your career, you really need to start overloading the leadership skills, you know, the influencing skills, collaborative skills, persuasion, you know, all of that, because to then be successful and bring those technical skills to pass in some kind of effective way, you actually need to get more and more of those soft skills and being able to lead through difficult times, you know, building teams, you know, all of those things. They're very, very important. And, you know, they're not sustainability specific, but for sustainability leaders, those are, I feel, very important. They're absolutely a must. So it's not just, you know, how much do you know? Like, can you recite the GHD protocol? You know, my God. But it's how can you make sure that you can create change? So I guess sustainability leaders are change makers. And it doesn't come as much from the technical skills. I guess it comes more from the leadership skills. And it's very important to continue to find time to develop yourself. And I know, again, we're talking about people working long hours, they're really passionate about the subject matter. You know, it's always the subject matter where they're applying the technical skills. But I think it's very important to take a step back, kind of get your head from out of the water and sort of go, okay, but how can I continue to develop as a leader and try to find those opportunities, because they will be so helpful in the longer term.
Mm-hmm. That's really, yeah, really important advice. And yeah, you do hear stories, and I have spoken to people who started their sort of way into sustainability, kind of moving, let's call it, up the hierarchy of sustainability, and finding themselves really quite poorly equipped for some of the challenges that they were faced with from a soft skills perspective. And, you know, realizing that, yeah, as you say, they could recite all these things and they knew all the technical stuff, but actually they were somewhat out of their depth when it came to going into a boardroom or, you know, putting a commercial case together or what have you. So yeah, I think focus on that. As you were talking, I was thinking about the University of Cambridge, CISL, the Sustainability Leadership School there. And I did a course with them, a postgraduate course, and I had kind of gone into it somewhat naively, I think, thinking that I was going to learn about sustainability sort of technically. And I sort of started the thing and I was like, kind of, oh, wait, hang on. This is all about being a change maker, making, you know, influencing systemic change. And I think it's courses and programs like that that are really needed, isn't it? It's kind of helping people grapple with those types of challenges. So yeah, not always assuming you need to know more, but you need to kind of develop more.
Yeah, and kind of think about how you can be more effective with what you do know to achieve the results that you want.
Well, I think it's been an interesting conversation with you. And we knew each other, we know each other, but I didn't know hardly any of that. So it's been lovely to find out more about you and your story and what's kind of driven you and your challenges as well. So thank you for being so open and honest about sharing the tougher times as well. I think we can learn a lot from that and the lessons that you've learned. So yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to interview you. And yeah, thank you for coming on the podcast and Rooted and sharing your story. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, I love talking to Maria there, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation too. I felt like I really got to know her on a whole different level there, and I loved particularly hearing her talk about her school days and when she was advocating for new policies and things in the classroom and better conditions in the school. And you can just see that track all the way through to the work she's doing now in the field of sustainable investment. So it's funny, isn't it, how these sort of stories carry their way through our lives. I think it was really actually really refreshing to hear her talk about how that health screening, I guess, brought her back from the brink of what could have been a burnout situation and some quite potentially serious health challenges. And so lucky for her that she was able to see that and intervene and put in place some practices that just pulled it back from that situation. And really speaks to the power of those kinds of screening programs and how important they can be. But also, in, you know, it's again what we need, those wake up calls, don't we, sometimes, to just remind us about our health and about our mental well-being. And I think it was lovely, wasn't it, to finish on a note of optimism, really, that, you know, although this work that we do goes in cycles and it can feel like somewhat of a roller coaster at times, not always easy when you're on that downward curve, but that this work is important for the long term, and the skills that people are developing and honing in the world of ESG and sustainability are absolutely needed across society. Now and in the future, I think it's important to hold on to that and remember that and take that forward into our work. So yeah, hope you've enjoyed that. Do let me know what resonated with you. I'd love to hear. Well, thank you so much for joining me on my yellow bench for this episode of Rooted. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, then please follow me or subscribe to Rooted wherever you get your podcasts. Please help others to find Rooted by either commenting or leaving a review or just telling your friends and your colleagues about the episode you've just listened to. And I'd also love to invite you to join my Rooted email community. The link for that can be found in the show notes. To chat more with me about the one-to-one coaching that I offer to sustainability leaders, please get in touch with me either via LinkedIn or yellowbenchcoaching.com. And finally, a big thank you to John Cropper for his editing and production of today's episode. See you next time. Bye-bye.